Life passes with us all a day at a time. So it passed with our friend Tom, till 2 years were gone, through parted from all his soul held dear. And though often yearning for what lay beyond, still was he never positively and consciously miserable. Welcome back to Bookwave. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat.
Hey, yeah.
And Jason.
Hey there. It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood.
Today we're looking at a classic known as Uncle Tom's Cabin. I guess we'll just jump right into it. If you're new around here, you can check us out at bookwave.club, our website, YouTube, Anchor, most podcasting platforms. We have a donation box if you're interested. And the first thing I want to talk about this book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, clearly a book about slavery, is we have two characters near the start of the book named Eliza and Tom, who are forced in the same situation but choose two very different outcomes. So whoever wants to answer this question first, which path would you take if you were to be sold into slavery? The path of Eliza, the one who takes the fight for freedom and goes for Canada, or Uncle Tom, the man who accepts his fate and goes into his new owner's house and accepts his fate?
So the more I read this and learning more about the two characters, the more I think about two different stories that happened in the past. With Uncle Tom, he's more like Jesus Christ, who manifests supreme virtue and goodness. And he's one of the very few slaves who just learns to accept the fact that he is going to die, but he still has the word of God on his side. And he allows that for him to grow as a human being. And he's not someone who's willing to stand out among the other characters and the other people. He's just somebody who knows for a fact that he is made it in God's image, and he is willing to accept that. Whereas Eliza is more of like Viktor Frankl in a way, who, if you don't know, Viktor Frankl was a psychologist, and he was a Holocaust survivor. And he did everything he could to stay alive by spreading the word of meaning and imagining a future where you are in the world of accomplishment. And so the more you think about that every single day, the more likely you are able to get out of that undeniable hell that you're in. And Eliza's kind of like that in a way. Maybe not on the same level as what Viktor Frankl may have gone through, but nonetheless, it gives that sort of what would you call it? Intellectually in-depth look of what it means to survive and keeping your own outcome on life above everything else.
I saw both Eliza and Tom as heroes in this book. Where, like you said, Pat, Eliza was kind of fighting in a way. And Tom was the stereotypical Uncle Tom, where he was a dutiful, long-suffering servant, faithful to his white masters. If I was placed in the position of either of these two, I think I would probably run like Eliza. But at the same time, a part of me would adopt more of an anti-hero stance if I was taking Tom's position. I would, like, the anti-hero in me would go and collect some bullets and get some metal and show these masters, you know, that I'm gonna go out on my own terms.
So you're almost taking, like, the secret third option of Eliza's husband, George, who he kind of takes off before he's put in the situation of, you know, between benevolent master and sold to the chaos of the great unknown, to the deep south or wherever. You don't know where you're going if you follow this new owner. But you know you have a chance at freedom if you go for the Canadian border. And of course, that's the one I choose because, you know, I love my country. I want to go home.
Yeah, I think I would take kind of a rebel position. Now, even up in Canada, to my understanding, a lot of these slaves that made it there ended up going back to Africa. They were repatriated to Liberia, which is adjacent to Sierra Leone. And one of the things I found interesting while researching this topic is they would have you believe that they were sent to Africa on good terms, but from my understanding is they were sent out of the country because the white majority did not want to live with them. They wanted a segregated society, and so they just sent everybody back to Africa to live their own life, and they developed the country of Liberia for that purpose.
Yeah, there is a little bit at the end of the book where it's like from George's point of view, I think, where it talks about like this country in Africa that's like a beacon of hope for, you know, African Americans to return to. So I don't know enough history about that. It could just as easily be that there was two simultaneous perspectives where, you know, the African American community wanted the same thing that the white community wanted, but for two completely different reasons. Like, they just, some wanted to integrate as well. Like, some people loved the United States that didn't want to go back to Africa, but I'm not sure if there was ever a situation where they forced them back to Africa after slavery had ended. So,
right. I think they were given a choice. The town in Sierra Leone was called Freetown, and they essentially adopted the same democratic representative democracy that we had developed here since George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. They set that up over there in Sierra Leone and Liberia.
I guess this kind of goes into how Stowe, the author of this book, kind of explores this idea of the idea of slavery and how evil it is. And not just because of that, but also providing certain consequences that follow and what separates good men and good masters from the bad ones. Like at the beginning, when the question was, which path would we take? There's a sort of exploration into the morality of the practice of living in slavery. And one of the things that that I picked up on was how the oxymoronic notion of slavery itself, but also just the power that is within that topic. It shows that kind of I'm not sure what you would call it, but it just shows what the best interests are in that. Like, for example, when we see, I think it was Tom, or no, not Tom. Now I'm forgetting about these names. Jeez.
Took us a while to read this book.
yeah, it took us a long time to read this and just trying to analyze it and everything. But
so there was Tom and there was Harry, which was Eliza's son. And they were owned by Arthur Shelby. And then they were sold to Mr. Haley. I don't know if this is filling in any of the blanks for you.
Yeah.
There was also like another character named Tom who was like a colleague of Mr. Haley, wasn't there?
Yes, Tom Loker. He was a slave hunter.
But anyway, it just shows a really interesting form of morality, as well as how the evil of slavery incorporates with Christian values. I don't know if any of you picked up on that.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned Viktor Frankl too, and he'd talk a lot about like the concentration camps, and like I think it was in Man's Search for Meaning where he mentioned how the SS would force the Jews to like just, you know, as a form of work, you know, take these bags of concrete, move them to the other side of the camp, and then get the second group to take the same bags of concrete and move them back to just create completely redundant work for themselves. And Viktor Frankl talked about how, like, he was able to find meaning in such a thing, like, which harkens back to the myth of Sisyphus. Like, even if you're just pushing a rock up a hill, day in and day out, and once you get to the top, the rock is always going to roll down to the bottom, and you know this is going to happen. You know, you're either going to push the rock up the hill or you're going to lose your mind. You're not going to have anything to do if you just sit at the bottom of the hill with your rock. At least you're doing something when you're pushing the rock up the hill. And I think a lot of that kind of mentality comes in Uncle Tom's story here, and like a lot of the Stoic principles that you might find, like even in that first quote that I read out, like he was never wholly miserable no matter what happened. And like, I don't want to give away too much context for what happened right before that quote, but you know, he goes through a lot in this book, and it's hard to read. I was just talking about how, like before we started, I don't think this book is meant to be enjoyed, but it's definitely important to read and to understand these perspectives.
There were two main themes that I noticed in this book, and one was showing some of the worst aspects of slavery, and this is what built the abolitionist movement, because they're showing how slavery splits up the family. We have Tom, who's married, he has children, and he's being sold, and he's going to leave his family behind. And then we have Harry, Eliza's son, who's essentially being taken away from his mother at a young age. The other aspect is the dehumanization of people. If you're a slave, you are essentially property. And we see this where we have Arthur Shelby. He's in a position of debt, and when he's a Kentucky farmer, when you are a farmer and you're in debt, you sell some of your property to make that money back. And in the time that this was written, Tom was considered property, so he was just selling property. Same with Harry, who's being sold. The other main theme that I saw was that the author was trying to show that Christian love can transcend and possibly fix these problems and aspects of slavery, that it will like the love that we saw between the fraternal love that we saw between Tom and Eva St. Clair, where she saw him as a person, not as just property.
Yeah, she saw him as a friend. She, like, there's one part in the book where she's pleading to her father, like, I want you to free all of my friends. She doesn't even consider using the word slave at all. Like, it's not part of her opinion of these people. Like, they're not servants, they're her friends.
Yeah, and same goes with how Miss Ophelia teaches Topsy how to read.
Right.
And understand words, and not just that, but understand the emotion behind the words.
Yeah, and it's only because of, you know, the lesson that Ava teaches Ophelia in the end that she's able to show that Christian love to Topsy. So, like, it's hurt people, but, you know, loved people can also love people. Maybe that's the other end of it.
Right.
There was a contradiction and some irony that I saw in the author's perspective that Christian love can transcend slavery. And that is that I saw it as it is from the Christian canon that essentially legitimizes slavery. So back in Genesis, we have the Old Testament where God is telling people to be fruitful and to multiply, to replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over every living thing on earth. And people have taken this to...
Yeah, the Bible also says your slaves shall come from the countries around you. So that's a hard one to get around too. But I think it's hard to compare, you know, where we are 2,000 years later or 1,800 years later, 6,000 years later, whatever it was, to like how long ago that was. Like, I don't think the Bible was ever making an excuse for slavery. It was just trying to, you know, tell the people that existed at the time how the world was, because there just wasn't a conceptualization of not having slaves. But clearly at the time where this book was written, the conceptualization of liberty and freedom was on the rise, just not for the people from the other countries who we've taken to be his servants.
Yeah, it was incomplete at the time.
Right.
Precisely. I mean, back in the time of the Hammurabi Code, there were codifications for how to have slaves, how to treat them, where you can get slaves from. Yeah. And then hundreds or a thousand years later, we have these ideas of where the American colonies fought a revolutionary war to free themselves from the Britain monarchy. And at the same time, these were Protestant people. So they were fighting against the Catholic doctrine and church that essentially said the Pope had dominion over the entire world. The Bible was written in Latin and you had to go through the church to understand it. And people didn't have the Bible to read. This was like, you know, 1300 AD. But this idea of having dominion over every living thing gets adopted into the discovery doctrine, where the Pope says, you know, we're going to go out on these crusades and spread the word of Christianity. And it's also part of the manifest destiny, where when the Americans first came to this country, they wanted to develop it in the name and under the banner of Christianity. They saw it as a mandate from their God to make this country flourish. And it was just part of life up until then that you could have slaves, you could have servants that would help you in that goal. So they didn't necessarily see it as wrong. They just saw it as a aspect of the conquest. And it wasn't until the abolition movement, right around when this book was coming out in 1852, around the 1820s up until 1852, the abolition movement was growing. And there was this idea that we shouldn't, that it's amoral to keep slaves, and it's certainly amoral to treat them the way they were being treated.
Mm-hmm. And you can go back to like the Hammurabi's code thing too, and like see how it might have split into two different kinds of things, like the two different forms of caste systems, like into like the kind of system they have in India, and or historically have had in India, and how it's progressed and changed. And you could see how it's done the same thing in the Western world with slavery. So I think like there's elements of each of these things that are just unavoidable. Like there's always going to be a form of hierarchy with, you know, some people are going to get left at the bottom and some people are going to rise to the top, and that's going to be inevitable. But the main thing we have to focus on is we can't like build that into the system. Like we can't make it systematic that those people who, you know, fall through the cracks and reach the bottom, we can't make it so we systematically keep them there and just assign them the role as the role of property, because that's just, that goes against everything we believe in. Atheist or Christian, I think we can all agree on, you know, people deserve sovereignty and liberty and, you know, the rights to do what we want with our lives and not be beholden to others.
And this goes back to the idea of what the system of slavery is in the book, because later on, I think this is right after, I think it was during Tom's trials after St. Clair's death, is when we finally get to see the ugly parts of not just the slave owners, but the slaves themselves, and how the system, the entire system of slavery, ends up losing what is right and wrong, and the latter of that effect extends even further. Like we see how some of the slaves turn against each other and make them more crueler, and how the plantation lacks a sense of religion in a way, or meaning, whichever one it is. And it is at that point on where we see a massive transformation in this part, especially with Tom as a martyr and saying that he would rather face a severe beating rather than just another way around it, like a shortcut or to avoid a particular punishment and just accept his fate.
He also realizes like those kind of choices have consequences, like back to the start of the book too, when he accepts his fate and decides, no, I'm going to go to my new owner. That's the fate my current owner has decided for me. He needs me to do this for him because he needs the money. Plus, if I just run for the border myself with Eliza and her kid, you know, I'm just going to be replaced by someone else. Someone else on this farm who I really care about is going to go in my place. And, you know, it's better I go than like my wife or my buddy here, whatever. Like he makes that sacrifice consistently throughout the novel.
Yeah, I think if he had run or adopted an anti-hero position, things would have been much worse for his family. His mm-hmm. wife and kid, they wouldn't have, they probably would have been sold. They would have been separated regardless. So yeah, he took up the mantle, and he took on the burden and just allowed himself to be sold. And ultimately, although I saw elements of a tragedy in this story, things do turn out good in the end. Not for Tom per se, but for some of the people he helped.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was being, after he was sold to Simon Legree, this cruel master, which shows how degrading people can be to these black people. He was refusing to give them the information they wanted because he was protecting Casey and Emmeline. And he knew told them where those two sex slaves were, that would be unethical. That would be amoral. So the best thing he could do was take on the burden, ultimately death, in almost a Christ-like fashion to keep the whereabouts of those two secret. And I guess it is giving it away, but in the end, Casey ends up being related to our introductory character, Eliza.
Yeah, it all comes in full circle, and they make a good... or the author does a good job of getting the point across that this is all because of the sacrifice of Uncle Tom. And it also is kind of like, not directly, but it's kind of accusatory. It's like, was this really necessary? Like, you've seen this story. Did we need to sacrifice Tom? Is in almost the same way to say, like, you've seen the story of Jesus Christ. Do you think that was just? Do you think that was right? Like, come on, like, these martyrs are important for this reason. Like, it gives everyone the perspective of saying, okay, even in the contrast of the benevolent slave owners and the tyrannical ones, it doesn't make a difference because, you know, if a benevolent slave owner just gets hit by a car one day, the family's going to need to make that money up. It's going to sell a couple more slaves to some bad families. And, you know, the cycle of hatred and fear continues. Like, no good can come of it. And, like, freeing the slaves is really the only answer. Like, a world with slavery is just unethical no matter what way you slice it.
Yeah, it took the country a long time to get to that point, because when this book came out, it was, I believe, originally posted as a serial novel in a publication called the National Era, which was an abolitionist newspaper. And after the author realized how popular it was, she expanded on it and turned it into a book. But the abolitionist movement was already growing strong before this, and with this book, it really catalyzed things. Abraham Lincoln was president back in this time, and I believe he attributed this book as being one of the aspects that led up to the Civil War. This was like a very controversial book when it came out, because for exactly the points we're talking about, it's stating that this whole system is built on an amoral foundation. Even though if you look at some of the biblical texts, you could use those as justification for the way the system has been implemented. But one thing I found interesting while researching the topic of slavery is, and something you mentioned earlier, Scott, the caste system.
Right.
It's really only in societies that have a caste system. There's a correlation between that and the level of servitude and slavery. So for the vast majority of our human history, we've had hierarchies, and there's nothing inherently wrong with having a chief or a hierarchy. But it wasn't until the agricultural revolution where we started to see stratification of caste and society that allowed us to...
would have been the point in history where we were able to sustain enough people in a certain society. Like, once we start planting food in the ground, we don't have to rely on, like, hunting animals or being a nomadic peoples as much anymore. We just stay put, organize our society in one spot with a large number of people, and that large number of people are going to have children, and populations are only going to grow from there. So you're going to need to figure out a way to organize them. And, you know, different societies all over the world have come up with different ways to do that.
Right. So back in the time of Hammurabi, the Egyptians, where we have a smaller group of top caste members that mm-hmm. need support, that we get this system of servitude and slavery. And like I was mentioning earlier, that when the Crusades happened, they used this idea of the discovery doctrine to say, any land we discover is considered new, and any inhabitants, they're going to be pulled under our banner of spreading the word of God. Because, I mean, ultimately, the Crusades, they were trying to get to Asia. They didn't know America was there, so they were trying to circumnavigate around Africa to get to the east side of Asia so that they could come up on the backside of the Muslims.
Yeah, they wanted to find India. That's precisely why when Columbus landed, he was like, hey, look at all these Indians. And then it kind of stuck.
So what did you think of the finale of this?
Which finale are you referring to? Like the after bit where it's like George talking about like his publications and stuff, or just the finale of Tom with his young master from the beginning?
Well, both, actually.
Maybe we should walk through the plot a little more before we get to the finale. So Tom sold, and Harry and Eliza escape, and they're being hunted by Tom Loker, which has been contracted by Mr. Haley. Yeah. And there was a aspect of a redemption story that I saw here with the slave hunter, Tom Loker. So he catches up with Eliza and Harry, and then he gets shot, I believe, by George.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't remember that part super well, but that sounds about right.
The aspect of redemption comes in later, where when Tom is being killed and Casey and Emmeline are escaping, that Tom comes in and helps those two ladies escape. So he's changed from a slave hunter to basically a helper. He's helping them escape.
Yeah, it's like you find these little victories in a story like this, and it makes you feel good. But like at the same time, it gives you these moments where it's like it doesn't make a difference as long as the law is the way it is. And I think that's the point that they were trying to make with the Tom Loker story. This guy realized that what he was doing is horrible. It could be called a sin. It could be called evil. It could be called whatever you want. And he decides to change. But at the end of the day, that's just an individual. And, you know, everyone is still going to expect him to do the same job that he's been doing for how many years, you know, catch the escaped slaves, their property that's running away. And once he realizes the error of his ways, it's like, oh yeah, that's just a drop in the bucket. There's still a lot of work to do here.
But this book brings up a dangerous idea for the country at its time, that the idea of the absolution of slavery. I mean, it led, or was one of the factors that led to the Civil War, where we have people fighting over this very idea that the states, should they be allowed to have the rights to legislate slavery in their own jurisdictions, or should it be permitted that the federal government outlaw and abolish it completely? And I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people died over this very idea.
Yeah. Like, we had this discussion on one of our Wavecasts about, like, the, you know, legalization of cannabis, just as an example. Like, when it comes down to just states' rights, should the federal government have this much power? Where, like, in, like, most normal situations, I would say, yeah, probably the state should have more say in what, you know, the state does. But when it comes to something as disgusting and evil as slavery, yeah, like, Abraham Lincoln needed to step in. There was just no other way around it. Like, if you're gonna fight a war to free yourselves from British rule, then, like, this is definitely a war worth fighting too. Which is, like, not too many countries go to war about slavery. Like, that says a lot about the South, but it also says a lot about how seriously the abolition movement took their goals. Like, they weren't going to rest until they had achieved freedom for everyone. And, you know, if war is the only answer, then I guess they were past talking at that point. But from my understanding, it was, like, the only reason the few states were allowed to keep their laws for slavery was because they needed their backing in, like, the American Revolution, or else they wouldn't have been able to defeat the British. So there's yeah, also like a, yeah, it was like a catch 22 there. What are you going to say, Pat?
Well, I was actually going to say that. I mean, there's some good things and bad things about it that can be beneficial, like I said before. But I think it all comes down to just control, you know, power. And it's just like, I mean, it's just like the idea of drinking alcohol. I mean, it can be good to some extent, but if you drink too much of it, then who knows where you will spiral to. And if you have a lot of power, you have to be moderately responsible for it and not just use it out on a whim, however you please. And this kind of goes into, you know, what we've been mentioning here. So,
yeah, and if we're going to have a conversation about power, who else to bring up but Friedrich Nietzsche and his will to power? You know, he'd have something to say about, you know, the morality and the religion of the people in this novel. Like, because when we were talking about Beyond Good and Evil, he was talking about everything coming down to the will to power. He described Christianity as a slave morality. So in a way, you could describe the slave owners as having a similar morality, in the way that, like, they don't have as much agency as they could. They could speak up, but they don't. Like, for example, the character of Ophelia, who preaches and preaches and preaches the whole book through about how abolition is going to be necessary. And, you know, she owns slaves herself. So it doesn't really, like, if you're not talking the talk, or if you're not walking the walk, it's useless to talk the talk. Like, you're not doing anything. Your morality is still pretty slavish if you don't have the power to make a difference. So, like, not to accuse Christianity itself of anything of the sort, but some of these, you know, characters that come off as, like, benevolent people who understand what needs to happen, they're also kind of like the villains in Atlas Shrugged, who don't really do anything for themselves.
Right.
But then you have the people like the Quakers, where they were doing everything they could because of their religion. So that would be the rebuttal against Nietzsche, because the Quakers were the ones that took in Eliza and George for the longest time and helped them get to the Canadian border, and they did all of it because of their religion. So, like, that's a good example of people during this time that, you know, unapologetically breaking unjust laws to do as much as they possibly can, but they're not exactly fighting the systemic part of it. Like, there's a difference between breaking the law to do what's right and fighting against unjust laws as they exist. What do you think about that?
Yeah.
I kind of see corollaries between this idea of a just master treating their slaves properly, and the more common system we have today, where you have employers and managers who are tasked with overseeing their direct reports, and the need to be a good, just manager. It would be a far stretch to say that employees are slaves. But I know I have heard that argument before. Yeah. From certain cynics that, you know.
Yeah, that's a good word for them, cynics. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, they equate, you know, working for a system or a corporation with some kind of modern day slavery. This idea that you have to treat your employees justly is still there. But there was a competing idea after this book came out, which was written in another book called Aunt Phyllis's Cabin. And right. Herein they were trying to portray the master or the slave owner as a benevolent, kind, caring person who would take people into their house and give them a life that they might not otherwise be able to have. Like, we had a couple stereotypes drawn from this book, one of which was the Uncle Tom, which is just a dutiful, faithful servant to their master. We had the Mammy, which is like a house nurse. So Eliza would be kind of considered a mammy. And then we had the Pickaninny, which would be like dark-skinned children who would dance and sing or run around the house, kind of for the amusement of the masters. But this idea of the benevolent master, I mean, it was competing with this idea that you can't be a benevolent master, essentially what the abolitionists were espousing.
Yeah, but, like, that's just the thing. Both stories can exist simultaneously. Like, I'm certain that there were a few families in the South during this time that treated their like slaves just like family, just like they would treat like their own children. But at the same time, like, it's just exactly what we've said before. Like, if something happens to those people, then what's to happen with the slaves? Like, you shouldn't, your entire livelihood can't be dependent on someone else that's fallible.
It puts people in a precarious position. I mean, we have two situations in this book where the owners are benevolent. We have the first, Shelby family, Arthur and Emily, and then we have the St. Clairs. But ultimately, when somebody is reliant on another entity for their ultimate well-being, you end up in like a tragedy.
Yeah.
And it kind of begs the question, like, is there any master to ourselves but ourselves? You know, should we allow ourselves to be subjugated by anyone but our own soul?
I think that's what God's for, right? Like, is that an argument that makes sense?
Well, I mean, like, that depends on what you mean by God.
Okay, if you are, you know, well, it doesn't really matter what I mean by God. If you have this abstraction that's in this higher realm outside of yourself, and that is what you worship and what you believe in, you're not going to get, you know, fooled by anything else. Like, I think that's a part of Uncle Tom's thing too, is that it doesn't matter who owns him. He says over and over again, like, no, I belong to the Lord, and that's all there is to it. He owns my soul, not you. You may have paid for it, but he's put his stamp on. He signed his name on my soul, and that is what I'm all about. But, like, I think that can also come from just yourself as an individual. I don't think you have to extrapolate it to something that you have to call God, but it is a tool that people use.
Right.
I think, yeah, I alienated probably a large swath of people and was giving more of a humanist, non-theist perspective. But yeah, if you are subjugating yourself to a God, you're essentially in a religion. But if you're doing the same thing to your quote unquote higher self, that is more of a humanistic position. And so your higher self, that can be kind of like a vague term. And I like to think of it in the terms of your future self. Yeah.
Maybe your best self.
Exactly. Yeah. Your future best potential.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah. And you see, like, this also comes into the conversation we had yesterday just about language. Like, I'm a humanist, materialist-minded kind of person, too. I'm just throwing in these elements of religion just because, I don't know, I want to try to translate anything that gets lost in our absolutely humanist perspective. I don't want to just have these conversations like, oh, this guy believes in God, and that helped him out, so that's pretty cool. Wouldn't work for me, though, but, like, these are the tools he uses. These are the framework. This is the framework that got him through, like, everything that he faced in his life. And he was never wholly miserable. And, like, that's a lot more than I can say for myself. So.
Yeah, and I think in the position these guys are in, if you tried to take the humanist position, it just wouldn't work. You know, they almost needed to to have this idea in Providence at the end, that this life was just going to be transcended and that they will be welcomed into like God's loving arms after all this is over, after their suffering and burden is done. Without that, you know, they could easily have fallen into hopelessness.
Yeah, that's when I start to think about Epictetus, because, you know, he was famous for being a slave 2,000 years ago, little bit more than that, I think. But, like, there's a famous story that gets thrown around about Epictetus where, like, him being a slave and his master, like, twisting on his leg and Epictetus just sitting there calmly saying, "Don't do that. You're going to break my leg. That's your property that you're breaking. Why are you going to break my leg? Don't break. Look what you've done. You broke my leg. Good job." So it'd be hard to say that Christianity had anything to do with, you know, Epictetus's lived experience, but I definitely think that he had some kind of connection with some form of the transcendence. Which even as an atheist, I don't think you can have a non-spiritual existence. Like, as much as you try to run away from the woo and all this and all that, it's like, no, it's part of your existence. There's things you can't explain. Magic is real. It just depends on how you define it. Does the magic come from you, or does the magic come from above? That's the real question.
Yeah, I've tried the non-spiritual path, and what I found is a lack of meaning down that path. And so while I'm not what I would call a Christian, I'm not what I would call a Buddhist, I'm somewhere in between, and I do have some ideas of a spiritual realm, something beyond just my body, something of greater importance, and that's what injects meaning into my actions. Mm-hmm. And without that, you end up kind of in the nihilistic trap of there is no meaning. There is no meaning to this world, so it doesn't matter what I do. And so that's one of the aspects that the characters in this book really portray, is they're putting their faith in Christianity, whether or not they fully understand it. They are unlikely to have been literate and have read the Bible, but certainly they have been exposed to it in the church and heard preachers talk. But I think that's what allows them to get through these really tragic lives they were living. It's kind of what allowed them to be a hero. If you look at it from like the hero's journey perspective, they were, if you look at this time in American history, you could call it hell. And so these characters are willfully trudging through that in the hopes that there's a providence waiting for them.
Like Dante's Inferno, you gotta tread through the underworld before you can make it through purgatory and then to paradise.
So was there anything else?
I'm trying to think here. I feel like I did have more, but
I pretty much said everything that I needed to say for this one. It's a book that you need to read at least once in your life. Again, it's not a walk in the park type of novel.
Definitely not.
It's just something that needs to be understood.
Yeah. And the actual prose of the book is incredible too. Like, there's so much drastic difference between when like each of the characters speak, like you get such a decent understanding of how all of these people talk, and like most of the dialogue is written out phonetically, so you can actually have that fly on the wall experience of like, oh, this is how they're pronouncing their words. And when it's just like narration, it's just written really well.
I kind of thought it was interesting how after this book was published in the South, it was essentially illegal. And if you were caught reading it, you could be jailed or lynched just for having these ideas. And I also found it interesting that this book sold better in Great Britain than it did in America. And it's possibly because it was banned in certain parts of the U.S.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I could also see, like, the contrast, though, like we were saying before we were recording, like, it makes sense that it would be more popular in a country that had already done away with slavery than in one where half the people were still fighting for slavery. And, of course, the controversy of the legality of the whole thing too, it wouldn't have been as accessible. Right. Like even as a Canadian reading this book, it was like, you know, when you're reading a book and you try to like put yourself in the position of some of the characters, like I always felt the impulse to be like, yeah, I'm Canadian. I'm the guy on the other side of the border helping all these guys, you know, come to freedom. But like, as Jordan Peterson always hammers home too, it's not always that simple. You know, if you were in Nazi Germany, chances are you would have had some reverence for the SS. You know, that's just how it works. Like you don't choose a lot of these things. And it's important to put yourself in the position of like the most horrible characters in this book. Like, imagine what it would take to have yourself be put in that position and like really analyze how you would react to that, because that's the only way you can be prepared for when those decisions actually come your way in life. Are you gonna stand for what's right, for what you believe in, or are you just gonna, you know, go along with the flow and say, oh yeah, those guys waging war all over the world, it's just the way it is. You know, the caste system, that's okay. It's just the way it is. Slavery, you know, it's just the way it is. You gotta be conscious about your decision making when it comes to important decisions like this.
As well as preserving your individuality.
Absolutely.
Well, I could easily see how somebody would fall into the trap of being an angry, cruel person like Simon Legree, you know, just based on the idea that people are property. If for example, right, somebody goes and steals, if your car runs away, you're going to go and chase it down. If somebody steals some of your property, you're going to do what you have to do to get it back. And if you're at the same time dealing with anger management issues and you're not happy with necessarily the way life is, because life back then was pretty tough, so I can imagine people were a little more hostile. But I could see myself in that position, and yet I would consciously, from my current perspective, choose not to act like that.
Yeah, and like going back to, if you see them as property, even if it's property that you love and respect that's running away from you, like your dog runs away from home, you're gonna go after your dog. That's your puppy. That's you want him back, obviously. And like, it's horrible to like make that kind of comparison, and that's not what I'm trying to say at all, but you know, I feel like that might have been the same kind of like understanding that they would have had. Like, The same thing if your car runs away from home. If you leave your car in neutral and it just starts rolling down the hill, you're gonna want to do something about that. If your dog runs away from home, you're gonna want to do something about that. If your slave runs away from home and you don't see them as a human, then you know, how do you go about that? Like, that's a perspective that's very difficult for me to step into, but just to consider that and think about it, to go backwards in history, to think about these things that have been human experiences, nothing is keeping them from being human experiences again in the future, except for our conscious awareness of it all.
I did have one question, and it was, why do you think this novel was so popular instead of just fading away into the histories of as a serial story in the national era? Why did it grab people's attention so much?
Well, it kind of goes back to what we were saying about systems and how it can greatly influence people's minds and where that outcome leads to. Like, there were some good slaves and good slave owners, and then there are some bad ones. And if you let a system, you know, overtake you, much like alcohol does to your mind, then who knows where it might lead you to. And it's always best to be cognizant of that. So I think that's, and especially with the idea of Christian morality that's mixed into this. And I think that's what the understanding of human beings is. And I think that's the reason why it became so popular.
Did you guys have an easy time identifying with any of the characters?
Off and on in pieces. Like, sometimes it was more difficult than others. Like I was just saying, I try to make a conscious effort to say, like, you know, what if I was put in this position? What if I was, you know, forced into some of these decisions? But some of it is a lot more difficult than others. Like Jordan Peterson says, it's, no one likes imagining themselves standing at the gate of Auschwitz. Like, but, you know, these are inevitable human experiences. So I hate to repeat myself, but just be cognizant of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was like one piece at the very end just from the author where it was like saying, you know, people have questioned me whether or not if this was fiction or something that really happened. And she talks about it being a blend of both. How it's like, how she said that each of these stories, I know absolute examples of people that have gone through this story, but I've just woven them all together here for you to, you know, take a look at all these examples of things that have happened. So, you know, you can decide for yourself if this is fiction or nonfiction. I'm just telling you, like, this is real. Fiction or nonfiction, it's real. So
I would kind of classify it as a historical fiction.
Yeah, but like, I think just that point there, like, fiction or nonfiction, it's real. That was, and it's so tragic and horrible, and it, perspective is more valuable than anything. So I think when people read this book back in the day, they realized that, you know, that difference between people as property and people as free agents, like, I think when that cognitive dissonance actually struck in, people lost their minds and they decided that this needed to be read by other people. These ideas needed to be explained to other people. And I think that's why it was so popular. Like, the necessity of this book is more of a factor than the, you know, how well it was written or like the literature and the prose of the thing. It's just the necessity of these ideas more than just an entertaining novel to read before going to bed.
I don't recommend reading this before going to bed.
Either do I, but I do all my reading in the morning, and then I was depressed for the rest of the day. So, you know, it works. Do whatever works for you.
Yeah.
I think that's a good little spot to wrap it up. Again, if you're...
Good discussion.
Yeah, really. It was good to finally get into this book. It's been a long time coming. And I hope there's some people still around listening. And if you are, remember we're on YouTube, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcast, all that good stuff. Got our website, www.bookwave.club. We got the donation box through Anchor if you're interested. And until next time, may the force be with you.
Later.
Won't you be my neighbor?